I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Gemma Farrell. Welcome, Gemma.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm really pleased that we were able to meet because you are a jazz saxophonist, a band leader, a composer and so much more, which we'll talk about. And you've got a new recording out with your quintet.
Yes.
That must be exciting. This is your ninth album.
It is, yeah. Yeah, no, it's very exciting, yeah.
And each time you make a new album, do you think to yourself, that's better than the last one?
I'm quite proud of this one. It's yeah, it's very different to anything I've done before. And it's also half of the output of my PhD. So it's had a bit more of an academic influence than the other albums have had. But yeah, I guess I suppose I probably do, especially if with my quintet, this is the third album, and I think it's the best album of my quintet so far, and that's because, you know, the longer you play together, the better you get. And but yeah, I think each album I do has a different concept, and yeah.
Let's come back to the to the other albums and how things might have moved and changed as you went along.
Yep.
But you're holding some strange looking contraption. What is that?
It is an electronic wind instrument, or EWI.
An EWI, an EWI.
Yeah.
And is that part of your repertoire?
It is now, yeah. So the subject of my PhD was the EWI and how it can influence saxophone players and their, well, specifically jazz saxophone players and their composition and improvisation. So there's three things that the EWI can do that the saxophone can't. It has an 8-octave range as opposed to a 2.5-octave range. You can make it sound like anything you want it to sound like, and you can also play harmony on it, whereas the saxophone is obviously a monophonic instrument. So it was sort of exploring those three things and what I can do, what those things allow me to do differently than the saxophone does.
I can remember when I was crazier than I am now about taking photographs and I'd go on a holiday,
mm-hmm.
and I'd carry these big bags back in the day of big lenses and all of that.
Mm.
But then you, these days, can go with a little, you know, latest iPhone and take great photographs.
Mm.
Can you take the EWI and leave all of the saxophones at home when you do a gig?
Well, I guess I could if I only wrote for EWI, but unfortunately, I write for saxophone as well, and I also, I sort of use the two together. So I might set up a loop using the EWI and then play the melody on the saxophone, and there's a tune on the album where I do that, but I also do the opposite. I set up a loop on the saxophone and play the melody on the EWI. I like to make things hard for myself, I guess. The sound of the EWI comes through the laptop, and to make it easier to operate on stage, I also have a set of pedals, and they're quite heavy. So, yeah, unfortunately, my setup has just got more difficult. But, yeah, I could just tour with an EWI and a laptop. I guess I'm crazier than that.
Well, the original jazz club would be just small enough or big enough to take you in an EWI, I suppose.
Yes, that's true, yes.
And it all fits into this, what looks like a large DIY toolkit.
Yeah, it's actually a rifle case. We when we got this instrument, which we were on the waiting list for 2 years for, it didn't come in a case, but it came in a box, and the foam fit nicely around it. So we took the foam from inside the box and we tried to find a case that would fit it. We were looking on eBay, and this is just a very simple plastic, what's called a rifle case. It is definitely not a gun.
Well, our listeners will also be able to be our viewers. Look at the photograph of you posing with the rifle case,
yeah.
and the EWI and the computer. Are you able to play a tune through the computer for us now?
Yeah, so I'll play the melody to a song I wrote for my daughter called Abigail's Song, using, I guess, what is the main sound I use, but it does have the ability to sound like anything, so it's definitely not the only sound I use.
Range of sounds that it can make. You've alluded to this. Does it equate with particular instruments?
You can really make it sound like anything you want it to sound like, because it is a synthesizer. And one of the people I interviewed for my research he plays the iwi and he does a lot of films in LA. He's based in LA and he does the soundtracks for most of the Pixar films. He did Finding Nemo, he did Wall-E.
You better give a shout out to him.
Yeah, his name's Steve Tavolone. He's an incredible, lovely, lovely person, but also an incredible musician. And he was good friends with Michael Brecker, who sort of is responsible for making the iwi famous. So I have it set up so, that's sort of the main sound I use, but I also, there's this sound I use here. And then I've got a panpipe sound. Yeah, I've got a range of different sounds. I've even got some drums I use on some tracks. That maybe doesn't sound too great coming through the laptop speaker. But then I also use this device, which I'm just going to need a bit more hands to make work without the pedals. So it's a device called the harmonizer, and it plays four notes at once. So I pick the top note, but the computer is picking the three bottom harmonies. So I could play the same note over and over again, but it would sound different every time because the computer's picking a different harmony every time.
Jim, our listeners are going to get cranky at me because I'm going to ask you some questions and they won't be able to hear you continue
playing. Oh, that's all right.
For the moment. But they will want me to ask you this. How did you make your way to the iwi when, I'm guessing, possibly when you were small, you learned to play a piano or something and then
yeah.
You progressed and you became crazy about jazz and saxophones and your formal musical education is there? And I think you've done your master's postgraduate work in Amsterdam,
mm-hmm.
and you've been led down a path. How did you get to this?
So you're quite right. I took up the saxophone when I was about 10. I think by the end of primary school, when high schools were interviewing me and saying, what do you want to do when you grow up? I was saying I want to be a saxophone player and I think my actual answer was professor of music, which isn't too different from what I'm doing now. But I don't think I definitely didn't fully grasp what that involved. When I eventually went to university to study jazz on the saxophone, I heard a recording by Michael Brecker. Michael Brecker actually, he passed away in 2007. He had leukemia. He was quite young when he passed away. But yeah, I remember listening to Saturday Jazz, which I'm now a presenter on RTR FM, the day he passed away, and they were interviewing Carl Mackey, who is a big Michael Brecker fan, and he played a recording of Michael Brecker using the harmonizer sound and playing the iwi, and he kind of just explained what he was doing, but also how the way he had to do it back in the 80s was really exceptional, because like I am very lucky where I can just have a laptop, and yes, I use pedals and stuff to make operating it live easy, but for him to do the same thing, he needed stacks and stacks of hard machine synthesizers. So I know that there's an interview with Bob Minzer, who's another iwi player. He plays iwi in the Yellow Jackets, and he said that he, there was a time where airlines would let you sort of have any excess luggage, and he would take heaps and heaps of synthesizers as well, and then they started charging, so he stopped playing the iwi. And it wasn't until an iwi came out with sounds inbuilt that he started touring with the iwi again. So anyway, getting back to Michael Brecker, what he was doing in the 80s was incredible, because the iwi only came out in the 80s. Just the way that Carl Mackey described this on air and what he was doing and what the instrument was, and I just thought that sounded really, really cool. And I've sort of always had a passion for anything saxophone related, and like I don't just play one saxophone, I like to play all of them. So the idea of another like saxophone fingering type instrument that I could control, and this one had even more possibility, like I just thought I want to be able to do that one day. And I ended up seeing a wind synthesizer advertised really cheap secondhand. It was a Yamaha WX7. And I purchased it, and I ended up playing it, playing the piece of Michael Brecker's, using not the harmonizer, because the software wasn't out yet and the hardware was expensive and mostly like not available anymore. So I ended up using a fifth sound to imitate what he was doing for my graduation recital. But it was, that instrument was quite difficult to play. It was, I think that instrument came out in the early 90s and just wasn't, I'm not sure mine was working properly either. And it was a difficult instrument to play, and I wasn't really enjoying it. And I ended up selling it when I moved from Brisbane to Amsterdam. But in Amsterdam, there was a guy who was a year above me. I was doing my first year masters and he was doing his second year masters. And his topic was the iwi, and he played a good one. And, I'd already had a play on an iwi like his, but not really known how to operate it. And I found it very difficult, so I sort of just left it. But then he was like, well, when I graduate, I'm setting up a program for woodwind-related master's students to do the iwi, and so I'll show you how to play it. Would you be interested? And I was like, definitely. And so, his name's Itai Wiseman, and he still lives in Amsterdam. He's from Israel. And he... So when I was in the second year of my master's, I got to do an iwi... project, or an iwi elective, an iwi class as an elective, at no extra cost, and
really love it.
Yeah, I really loved it. And he was endorsed by the company that was making, so not this iwi but another one, he was endorsed by the company that was making the iwis at the time, Akai, and he got the uni a deal, like he got the iwis provided for the class, and we had the opportunity to buy them at the end of the class. And so it was like a $1,500 instrument, but I ended up being able to buy mine for 300 euro.
Well, how nice.
Yeah, so I purchased that iwi and moved back to Australia. And, you know, while I've been here, as well as like doing my quintet and stuff, it's also like my husband and I have been like trying to set us up. And we had one daughter when we lived in Amsterdam, and then when we moved back, we had two more children. And so iwi definitely got put on the back burner, but I knew I wanted to do a PhD one day. And I was speaking to Jamie Ollers, who's been my supervisor for my PhD, about possible topics I was interested in, and I sort of came to see him and I was like, I want to do my PhD and these are topics I'm interested in. And he saw the iwi one and he was like, oh my god, do that. And he was like, just because he was sort of saying what makes a really good PhD if not much has been done on it before. And he was like, no one will have done, there won't have been much info on that, do that.
Yours will be the definitive work when it's later published as a book.
Yeah, well, there was some work done in the 90s, but mine in particular focuses on the impact on saxophonists, and whereas others are sort of just research on the instrument, which is also like very important. It's I guess mine just focuses on the effect of the
on saxophonists
who play them.
You mentioned woodwind.
Yeah.
Does it fit into that family?
It's definitely got, I feel, yeah, it would be more the synthesizer family, but it definitely has a woodwind fingering system. So if you play flute, clarinet, saxophone, even oboe, like this is a really good instrument to play if you want to get into doing synthesizer related stuff. I should say the instrument was initially invented by a guy called Niall Steiner. He's still alive, and I've got to speak to him and interview him as part of my research. And he is, as well as being a synthesizer repair person, he was a very good trumpet player. And he basically got a job repairing synthesizers and got really into synthesizers, but he couldn't play piano. And he was like, well, it's kind of unfair that only keyboard players have access to these instruments. So he invented an instrument called the EV, electric valve instrument. Basically,
this is an old trumpeter.
Yeah. So he brought it in. He was meeting with the guy who did the soundtrack, or the guy who made the movie Apocalypse Now, and he brought in his EV to show him, and he was like, I want that on my movie. So the debut performance of the EV was the soundtrack to Apocalypse Now. And, basically when saxophone players in LA who were also working on movies saw what he was doing with the EV, they were like, can you make us a woodwind? And then when these instruments came out, the woodwind one just became so much more popular. And that's because there are more saxophone players than trumpet players doing movies.
What are the range of musical settings in which the iwi is today being played?
I would say mostly movies and soundtracks, but also jazz, and sort of funk, and people who do like programming. There's a guy called, his Instagram handle is Eddie Iwi. He's another person I've interviewed for my research, and he's also like, his day job is like an engineer. So he knows a lot about like electrical wiring and stuff. So he actually makes his own sounds by, like, you see he does a live stream every night when he comes home from work, and he just loops himself. So he'll put down a bass line and the drums, and then he'll just improvise over the top for hours and hours and hours. and you see his setup on his desk, and he has cables plugged into cables plugged into cables, and it's just insane because he knows, like, I don't really know.
He knows how not to electrocute himself.
Yeah, I would say sound design is not my forte, whereas some iwi players really get into that, and he's someone who's really got into that, whereas I just look for what great sounds have been made for iwi players, and I use those because it's important when you play a wind synthesizer that you have sounds that respond to breath, like the saxophone would. You know, if you, I sort of initially, when I started using sounds on a laptop, we're using keyboard synthesizer sounds, and they're sort of not very fulfilling because, you know, with the keyboard, you just press a button. And so it was sort of like I'd blow and the sound would come out, but it wouldn't have any dynamics, or it wouldn't necessarily hold the note as long as I was holding it. And I was like, oh, I don't like this. But then I discovered the sounds that were actually made for these instruments. And
When I'm in New York, as though I'm there every other week, I go to a place like Dizzy's, and these great jazz players come in. And of course, they'll either be hitting a keyboard, or they'll be playing some sort of trumpet or sax and other things happening. And of course, they can stand up, and they've got a big instrument in front of them, and they can make the most of it, and you go, wow, wow, wow. How do you play in that sort of setting such a small little instrument? You stand up and wave it? Do you put it vertical? Do you have a theatrical technique?
Not really. I just, stand up and play it like I would a saxophone. And I the way I communicate with the band is very much the same. Nothing really changes in that respect. I guess it's like playing if you include the mouthpiece, it's probably the size of a trumpet lengthwise, and not too different from a soprano sax in that way. My particular instrument I started using this instrument, I think it was December 22 where this came in the post. This instrument is made by a guy called Johan Berglund. He's a Swedish guy, and he has his own company, Berglund Instruments, which is dedicated to making iwis and evies. And he's basically been responsible for bringing the evi back to life, because that instrument kind of went away for a bit. No one was making it. And if you did get your hands on one, it was like a really old secondhand one from the 80s. He 3D prints them, and you can choose your color. Mine's purple. and the iwi design, he is going to do an iwi design where you have the left hand on top and the right hand on the bottom. But my iwi is based on the design of an iwi that Niall Steiner made called the Rad iwi, and this is called the New Rad iwi, and the hands, the left hand and the right hand, are opposite to each other, like an ocarina sort of thing. And that's like, it's still saxophone fingering. To me, it doesn't really matter whether my one hand's below the other or opposite the other, my hands will still do the same thing.
Now, let's go back a step.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz.
Mm-hmm.
10 years old.
Yeah.
Sax.
Yeah.
Where did this all come from?
My dad sort of brought it to my attention that there was a saxophone in the family. My late grandfather, he passed away when I was 1 year old, so I never really knew him, but apparently he had a great love of jazz. He brought my cousin, who's I think 10 years older than me, a saxophone, with like, because he just felt like someone in the family should play jazz. So he did that, and it kind of sat under my cousin's bed doing nothing, like he
gathering dust.
I think he tried, decided it really wasn't for him. And my dad sort of one day said to me, like, hey, there's a saxophone sitting under Clayton's bed, and I think he'd be really good at it. So, let me know if you want to learn. And I was like, yeah, that'd be cool. And I think in the beginning, I wasn't really big on practicing and maybe wasn't even in love with it. It was sort of when, you know, people started asking me what I wanted to do when I grew up at the end of primary school that I started really thinking about it and thought, actually, yeah, saxophone would be cool and maybe I am getting okay at this. And I started to practice more without being asked and, yeah.
Did you go through the specialist music schools when you were primary school or high school?
I mean, my primary school, I don't think there is really a specialist music primary school, and I definitely didn't get into the IMS test, which I'm quite critical of. I think it's more of a comprehension test and it doesn't necessarily pick out the gifted musicians. But, and in an ideal world, all primary school children should get the opportunity to learn an instrument. But anyway, I just went to my local primary school, and when I went into high school, I got a scholarship to go to Perth Modern School. And back when I went to Perth Mod, before it was the academic specialist school, it was the music specialist school. And my daughter now goes to Churchland Senior High School, which it was, I think when I went to Mod, it was a very close second best specialist music school, and now it's by far the best music school since the academic program moved to Mod and the music program left, which is, you know, obviously sad to see. But yeah.
Now, Mozart had a sort of musical dad who encouraged him greatly. Do you think from all your experience and where you've been and the people you've been referring to that music comes in actual families, that it's passed down genetically?
That's a good question. I think it definitely helps if your parents are musical. Like, there's definitely been families. I mean, one famous example is the Marsalis family. Ellis Marsalis played piano, and then he had Branford, Winton, Delfeo and Jason all become professional jazz musicians who are killing it now.
Yeah.
So I think that definitely helps, but I, you know, I that doesn't mean that if you haven't got a musical family, you can't get into it. My family, there were no professional musicians in my family, but they never, I have heard stories of families that, you know, and I've also experienced it with students who, like, they have families that are just like, well, yeah, music's not really something, like, why would you do that? Like, and that's not going to make you money. And, yeah, so, but my family never did that, thankfully. Yeah, it's probably a good thing. It's definitely a good thing they never did it. I wonder now if they know the realities, if they might think that they should have done that. But I've definitely read stories about families that didn't encourage music. I know Nina Simone's, like, she lied to her parents about playing music professionally, and it wasn't until, like, it came out that she'd won some prize, and that's why she went by Nina Simone, which wasn't her real name, was to sort of hide from her parents. And, you know, that's sad. I think we're headed towards a world where more and more people are going to be turning to the arts. Obviously, things are looking pretty grim right now for artists. But with AI, you know, forcing people to give up their jobs and taking over some jobs, and I hope that we're going to turn to a country that eventually has universal basic income, so that everyone gets a living wage and perhaps can explore what they want to do a bit more, and the arts maybe become a bit more valued, and maybe, you know, someone who can't work at Woolworths anymore and is reflecting on what they really want to do will go, hey, I've always wanted to play the sax. So, yeah, I hope that that's an old mentality that gets driven out, Yeah, I'm really thankful that my parents were only ever encouraging and, you know, obviously paid for my lessons. And
well, your dad pulled the sacks out from under the bed.
Yes, and then, you know, a couple of years later when I had been playing a while, they got me a much better sax and then eventually a professional sax. And I'm sure, like, those instruments were very, very expensive. And, you know, they weren't super wealthy people. But, yeah, they always supported me. And, like, yeah, my grandparents drove me all the way to Perth Mod when we didn't live around the corner. And, yeah, so I try to be the same way with my kids and very much encourage music. And, yeah.
It's a lovely story. It's lovely to hear you speaking about it like that and to be so committed. And as you say, your statement when you were 10 or so that perhaps you'd be a professor of music.
Mm.
You're now teaching
yeah.
at WAPRA at the Conservatory. How's that going and what are you teaching and how engaging do you find that?
I teach mostly one-on-one saxophone lessons there, and I also take a large ensemble and a small ensemble. So when I say a large ensemble and a small ensemble, both ensembles are relatively the same size. It's more that the subject, so the subject small ensemble is a compulsory subject that they all do, and there's like 4 to 7 band members, and they all have their core repertoire that they need to learn and perform together regularly. And then large ensemble is an extra subject, and there's different large ensembles that specialise in different genres. So my large ensemble is the New Standards Ensemble, and that is based on a book by Terry Lynn Carrington. So Terry Lynn Carrington in 2021 brought out a book called New Standards, 101 Lead Sheets by Women Composers. And it was basically, because if you look at the real book, it's 99% written by men. and they're great tunes, but when you're looking for repertoire from women, there was really no key source for that. So the ensemble I run at WAPA, we do tunes from the New Standards book, and we're performing at the Ellington on May 23rd. Yes.
Wow. So, how many in the ensemble?
So I actually play saxophone in the ensemble, and there's another saxophonist and a trumpet. We have a vocalist and then a four-piece rhythm section, so 8.
And for our listeners, does it go under a name?
Just the New Standards Ensemble. So yeah, if you look on the Ellington website on the 23rd of May, and it should say New Standards Ensemble, and yeah, that's the gig.
And you're going to be playing any tracks from your new album, which I think is being released on the 3rd of May.
Yep.
And it's called Electronica.
Electronic. Yeah.
Electronic.
Yeah.
I added an A, yeah. Mainly because I
That's
get
right.
crazy about electronic music, actually.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the new album now.
Yep. So, yeah, as I mentioned, it's the output of my PhD. So there's tunes on there that were written that were influenced, that feature the iwi, but also tunes that were very much influenced by the iwi. So even though there's parts on the album where they might have a particular sound because I just decided I liked that sound, or there's also tunes where I play the bass role because I can play really low on the iwi, and the bass player plays the melody. So we explore different roles, and there's also saxophone tunes where I play the saxophone in a tune. For example, there's a tune that I wrote because when I was examining my playing through, because I had to do, and I'm still doing heavy analysis on my playing throughout the research period, I noticed that I wasn't playing a lot of major six. So then I wrote a tune for saxophone which had mostly major six in the melody. And to write a tune in that way, Because the approach to writing the melody was quite different, it also then made the chord change quite different, because I sort of wrote the melody and I was like, okay, now what chords are going to fit with this melody? And it's not the friendliest chord progression in terms of like easy to play over, but I quite like how it turned out. It's very different. So yeah, there's a couple of tunes with just saxophone on it, but there's a lot of tunes with iwi and saxophone, and then there's some just iwi tunes as well.
When you first recorded,
mm-hmm.
and you could answer this either by reference to your quintet, with
mm-hmm.
the three albums, or yourself earlier, how would you describe your progression? Have you composed everything for each of the albums?
Yes, I have. So if I talk about it in terms of the quintet, I remember when we recorded the first album as a group, we spent a lot of time. We did like 2 days, well, we did a few days rehearsing at Whopper, but we did like 2 full days at Whopper where we were there like all day Saturday, all day Sunday. We like Uber Eats coffee. That's the first time I've ever done that, because nowhere was open. And yeah, and we practiced to a click track as a group, which we found really, really challenging, because we were going to be recording to click. So we were like, okay, we need to be able to do this. Let's put on a metronome really loud over the speakers and practice along to it, and we actually found it really challenging, come now to our third album, it's something we're very used to and we find really easy, and I feel like we're better because we're used to playing with each other, we're better because we've developed as musicians, we're all very comfortable with each other as well, so if someone has an idea, we're happy to try it out, or if someone has an idea, someone else is also not afraid to go, oh, that's not a great idea. I think we communicate really well as a band.
You're all talented at what you do, and everyone's playing their part. Probably should give a shout out to them all.
Yeah.
How often do you get together and perform?
Usually we get together just before we have a gig. So we're not a band that rehearses regularly, and I don't think any band, well, I won't say any band actually, but I would say most professional, particularly original jazz bands in Perth, probably do just get together before the gig, but the getting used to playing with each other is developed over a number of years. We started in 2015, and initially I had Naomi Tan on drums, Kate Pass on bass, James Van Der Veen on trombone, and Chris Seeley on guitar. But Naomi Tan, after I formed the group, very shortly after, she moved to Melbourne and she recommended Ryan Daunt. So Ryan Daunt and Kate Pass played on the first album with Chris Seeley and James Van Der Veen. And then we were looking at, we did the first album and then we did a tour in 2019, and the day after the album launch in 2018, James Van Der Veen moved to Japan. I then got in Sam Hadlow, who's still in the band, on trombone. Chris Seeley had just started studying medicine. When we found out we got the funding for the tour, soon after he got his exam schedule, and it turned out all of his medical exams clashed with the dates of the tour. So he left the band, and then Dan Garner came in on guitar. So the band for the second album was Dan Garner, Sam Hadlow, Kate Pass, Ryan Daunt. And then that's also the lineup for the album we've just recorded. Kate moved to New York, I think 2 or 3 weeks after we recorded Electronic. So now we have Lucy Browning on the bass, who's a really great young bass player. We did a gig last night and she played so well. Some of the tunes she was playing with us, because we were intentionally trying not to play too many tunes from the album to make people come to the album launch. And so she was performing some of those older tunes with us for the first time, and she did really well, yeah.
So tell us about the album launch.
The album launch is the 4th of May at Lyrics Underground. Lyrics is definitely one of my favourite venues in Perth, and I think it has the best sound person in Perth, her name's Rosie. She's just so good at what she does. And with an album like this, where it's not just acoustic instruments, it's really important to have really good sound. So, and Lyrics, it's just a great venue, friendly staff and great vibe and good food. And we'll be playing two sets, which will make up the whole length of the album, and there'll be CDs for sale, as well as other merch like t-shirts and bucket hats and mugs and stuff. And it'll just be a fun celebration.
Composing.
Mm-hmm.
Women.
Mm-hmm.
You've mentioned
mm-hmm.
the broad topic. When did you first start composing and, in a sense, being taken seriously for your compositions?
I remember, I think I'd always sort of like dabbled in it, but not seriously from a young age. But I remember sort of the moment where I decided I was gonna take it seriously in a jazz setting was I had an ensemble when I was studying at the Queensland Conservatorium, and I took that ensemble very seriously. As a student, I took all of my subjects really seriously, but I was sort of getting frustrated with a particular band member who, when he came, he played really, really well, but he was quite unreliable. We never knew if he was going to show up, and when he did show up, he was often late. And I kind of, said to him, what's going on? Why don't you take this very seriously? And he was like, I think you take this too seriously. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, well, this is the only ensemble you've got, right? And I was like, well, what do you mean I'm playing? And he was like, yeah, but you don't do anything outside of uni. You should write your own stuff and have your own serious group. And even though I don't agree that he was saying I took the ensemble too seriously, I do agree that I did sort of listen to that and go, actually, yeah, I should start my own projects as well.
So instead of being as grumpy about all of that, you can acknowledge he can take some credit for getting you into composing.
Well, yeah, I was, as I said, I was sort of doing it, but that sort of was what made me go, okay, I'm going to put my own trio together and we're going to play some standards, but I'm also going to slowly bring in some compositions. And then just before I left Brisbane, I put on a original gig with a quintet, different lineup. I had a piano instead of a guitar and a trumpet instead of a trombone. I had my own tunes as well as standards and tunes that I'd transcribed that I liked from recordings.
Gemma, do women compose / play differently from men?
No. It depends on what you mean. I feel like every person uses their own experiences to compose with. So everyone composes differently. Are women less capable? You know, does the level of testosterone that they don't have somehow contribute to that? Of course not. Yeah, some of my favorite composers, I mean, I think one of the most exquisite jazz composers who has ever lived, especially in a big band settings, is Maria Schneider. Yeah, whatever drug she's on, I want it. her music is just absolutely sublime. And, you know, I could name a handful of women. Are they taken as seriously? Well, I think that there's definitely not enough representation on the stage when there definitely could be more. Which is something that with my project, the Artemis Orchestra, I try to tackle. You know, in Perth, we have so many great female jazz musicians. And yet, if you look at most lineups for most original jazz gigs, it'll be four men, maybe one woman, usually a singer. And I don't really think there's any excuse for that anymore. Like, I think if you have a band that you've been playing with for years and years and years and it's all guys, I'm not asking you to, like, not continue in the name of diversity. But if you are putting a new band together, I think you should really be aware of who's watching you. And there's always going to be someone younger. Even if you're only 17 and you're putting on your first gig with your first original band, there might be someone in high school, you know, a young woman or trans person or non-binary person who sees themselves on the stage and goes, you know what, it looks like I'm welcome in this space, or it looks like I can do this too. And I think that is so much. And I think in Perth, where we're a very white society, where I look at the lineups for all bands and it is mostly white men, you know, we really have to be aware of that. And, you know, if we do have the opportunity, you know, if we're looking at two people who are equally as good and one person's a woman or one person's not white, then perhaps pick them, because you know, that their visibility, like, that's going to mean so much to someone in the audience, I reckon. And yeah, I just think it's so important for those people to be seen, because we do have some really talented women, trans, non-binary, people of color in Perth, and they're just not getting as much stage presence as cis white men. And I don't want cis white men to do any less than they're doing. I don't wish them any misfortune, but I do want equality for everyone else. And I don't know if it will happen in my lifetime, but I hope for a day where I don't have to think about this issue anymore.
Your commitment in that regard, I think, shows up in various ways. You run the WA Youth Jazz Orchestra's Progressions Pathways program, which was nominated for an APRA AMCOS Art Music Award for Excellence in Music Education. That must be fulfilling.
Yeah, I've been nominated for a few awards for my work in that space. And it's always nice to be recognised in that way, to know that someone's noticing. But it definitely sometimes feels like I'm banging my head against the wall, like that people aren't listening. Whenever the Artemis Orchestra, which is an orchestra I formed that only it's a big band predominantly of women and also including non-binary and transgender members, and we only play music by Australian people of marginalized genders, original music. And I formed that to tackle this issue, and I always do a diversity speech at every gig and talk about what we're about and why I think it's important. And I often have young men coming up to me and saying like, oh, I agree so much with what you're saying, good on you. But then when I see them put their own band on, it's them and all their mates. And it just feels like I'm getting nowhere, and it can be incredibly frustrating. I do look forward to the day where I don't have to think about it. And unfortunately, I think I'll probably be on my deathbed saying, just hire more women.
Like, Jimmy, you've also been one of three finalists for the 2022 and 2023 Australian Women in Music Awards in the humanitarian category.
Yeah.
Can you explain to our listeners a little bit about that?
So Holly Scott nominated me for that. She's an incredible local female vocalist. So it's the Australian Women in Music Awards are held in Brisbane every year, and they have a number of different categories. The humanitarian category, I was nominated for my work with the Artemis Orchestra and for the work with Progressions, as well as I put on a jam called the Femme Jam with an all-female rhythm section for people of marginalised genders. So, for the work I'm doing in that space, I guess, yeah.
And as well as all these other things you are being recognised for, you were one of 16 Australian musicians nominated for the Friedman Fellowship Award in the jazz category in 22.
By Mace Francis, who's he's an incredible musician and local. He's a local jazz musician and composer, but he, as well as doing his own stuff, which is really great, he runs both WAJO, West Australian New Jazz Orchestra, and the Perth International Jazz Festival. So he's a great jazz advocate as well.
Gemma, not everyone gets jazz.
Mm-hmm.
I've sort of intimated I love jazz. There's something crazy about jazz, and it seems to have defied everything that has tried to marginalise it or not make it popular or whatever. What is it about jazz that has always attracted you and has kept you there? Can you explain that feeling, or do you just have to be there listening to your play?
I feel like that word jazz is maybe a bad marketing. that word means so much. Like, there is so, like, beyond 100 years of music in that word, and that word means everything from improvisation was started from call and response in the cotton fields with African American slaves in US history. And then from there we had New Orleans Dixieland jazz in the early 1900s, and ragtime, and then we had the swing era and big band music, and then we had bebop and cool school and post bop and hard bop and all these different genre terms.
To avoid using the word jazz.
Yeah, well, fusion. And the thing is, I was thinking about this last night because I did a gig with my quintet last night, and we were playing stuff that I guess if you had to label it, I've noticed sort of everything after fusion has the label contemporary jazz, and that's kind of maybe too big a term as well, because there's so much stuff in that term. So I was thinking, like, we just finished playing this contemporary set, and then they put on the house music, which was Billie Holiday singing All of You. And I was just, I just sort of had this moment of like, what we just played comes from that. And it's all the same idea, in that you are trying to be melodic, you're improvising, you're interacting with the group, whether it's a standard or whether it's my original, yeah, it doesn't really change the way I try to interact with the group. And I don't think there's anyone in the world who doesn't like jazz, in that people might say that they don't like jazz. You know, maybe they heard something they didn't like, and that was, and you know, someone said, oh, well, that's what jazz is. And they're like, okay, well, I don't like jazz, but I'm sure I can find a recording that they would be really into. You know, I remember when I first met my husband, he knew I was a saxophone player, and he went out to a store in the city called Dirt Cheap CDs, and he brought like a Coltrane, a John Coltrane mix. And for someone who's just getting into jazz, that can be a bit much. And I remember at the time I was in my first year studying jazz, and I wasn't really into Coltrane either. And he said to me, like, oh, I listened to this Coltrane album. You're not really into him, are you? And I was like, no, no.
Everyone's supposed to like Coltrane.
Yeah. But now my husband and I love Coltrane. And I feel like it's like coffee or a good glass of wine. And I say that as someone who doesn't really like wine, because I haven't had that exposure to it. But, you know, you don't give coffee to a 10-year-old and expect them to like it. It's bitter, and it's, yeah, but like, to me, there's nothing better than a good cup of coffee. But I started drinking coffee with mochas that were more of a hot chocolate than they were a coffee, and you know, and got into it that way. And you know, maybe you start by listening to someone like Maceo Parker, who was James Brown's saxophone player, and who very much plays funk. And maybe from funk you get into fusion, and maybe from like listening to Weather Report you then go to Wayne Shorter and then Coltrane. Or you know, I think Kind of Blue is one of the most beautiful incredible albums ever written, and that's often a good starting point, especially for young jazz musicians who are trying to get into transcribing, which is when you write down someone's solo and try to learn it to help you with your improvisation. Yeah, so maybe you start there, and from Miles you check out Cannibal Adderley, and yeah.
Arthur Fiedler famously put down a LP with the Boston Pops, which was called Classical Music for Those Who Hate Classical Music.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably an opening for a jazz album that does something like that, that introduces people to the whole history of it. Who are your influences, though, or who do you love now? Coltrane's made it.
Yeah, Coltrane's amazing, and I do need to check out a lot more of him, particularly in a transcription sense. I really like an album of his that I was exposed to when I was doing my master's, called Dakar, and he plays that album with two Barry sax players. I think it's Cecil Payne and Ronnie Cuba, but it might be Pepper Adams actually. I'd have to check that, but yeah, that's probably my favorite Coltrane album. Most recently, actually from having recorded this album, someone said to me that Steph Haynes, who's a great iwi player, he did a little review in the liner notes for the album, and he said it sounded like Marky Hill, and I've never heard of Marky Hill. So I've been listening to him, and yeah, he's a really...
And you're very pleased.
Yeah, he's a really great trumpet player, and yeah, I'm very like touched to be compared to him. I also I really like a saxophone player based in the US called Alexa Tarantino. I've been listening to a lot of Mario Bildstein stuff. In terms of influences, I'd say my favorite tenor saxophone player ever is Stanley Turrentine, and maybe favorite album ever is, he plays on his wife's album. He was married to Shirley Scott, a great organ player. So Shirley Scott, Queen of the Organ, and his soloing on that is one of my favourites. But my local heroes, Sandy Evans, when I was having difficulty and getting given a bit of a hard time by some of the men in the scene in Perth, I went and had some lessons with Sandy, and that was at a point where I was considering giving up the saxophone, and she encouraged me to keep going. And yeah, she's an incredible, incredible saxophone player, and just, you know, it's hard for me, as it has been hard for me as a woman in jazz, and I'll be turning 37 later this year, but Sandy's in her 50s, and yeah, and so if it was hard for me, it was harder for her. And I also very much admire Louise Denson, who was the head of music at the Queensland Conservatorium when I studied there, and she was the first female instrumentalist to be on salary in an Australian university, and the first one to be a head of jazz program, in a jazz program, I should say. Yeah, great pianist as well. She's now retired and living in Tasmania. Yeah, they're kind of my local heroes. Graham Norris was my saxophone teacher when I lived in Queensland, and he's the most incredible saxophone teacher I've ever encountered. Just a really great teacher, and was really good at like picking up on what I didn't know and explaining it to me really well. Yeah, I still hope to catch up with Graham, because obviously he lives in Brisbane now and I live in Perth. But yeah.
It'll happen. Gemma, it's been inspiring talking to you. You are blazing the trail for others, plainly. As we wrap up after an hour of really interesting chat, What about taking us out on the iwi?
Oh yeah, okay, what can I play? Maybe I'll play the head to All the Things You Are, which is a tune that I used it as the control piece for my research, so I had to record it every week. But I'll play it using the harmonizer on the iwi. Yeah, so you can see how that'll be quirky probably.
Gemma, it's been a delight. Thanks.
No worries.